Today's guest is Dr. Rachel Gabriel. We'll talk about the newly published book, How Education Policy Shapes Literacy Instruction, which includes chapters she authored and co-authored, and which she edited. Specifically, we'll explore the history of studies related to teacher quality and instructional materials, and what research shows makes the biggest difference in supporting early literacy growth. Later, I'm joined by my colleagues Macy Kerbs and Molly Wood for a conversation about practical takeaways. This is the To the Classroom podcast, and I'm your host, Jennifer Saravallo. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be with you.
Awesome. So I've read several chapters out of the recently published book, How Education Policy Shapes Literacy Instruction, that you edited, and you wrote a few of the articles as well. It is such an incredible contribution to the field. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you.
I thought we could talk about two of the chapters that you wrote or co-wrote. Let's start with the chapter focused on teacher quality. Early on, you discussed the Bond and Dykstra 1967 first grade studies that looked into whether pupil, teacher, class, school, or community variables were related to achievement. What did they find?
They found an idea that sort of undergirded more recent teacher evaluation policy, which is that the teacher makes the biggest difference of all the variables that you listed. Classroom differences, and in this case, they were thinking about the tools teachers were using, which now we would think of as like which Basel reader or did they have a Basel reader, what curriculum materials, that they didn't make as much of a difference in terms of achievement, that teachers could use material, any of the materials could be used to either good effect or to poor effect. And it really just depended who was using them.
It's so important. And it's a really important thing to keep in mind. In this era of approved lists of programs and not approved lists of programs, and the way that funding is or isn't supporting teacher professional development, right? If that finding holds up, and I wanted you to talk next about Connor's work, because I think that's relevant as well. And what studies were found about beginning literacy instruction and teacher or teaching quality.
Yeah. So I think I can back up a little bit from Connor's, because the main finding of Bond and Dykstra has held up, and it's been looked at a couple of different ways, and not only within the beginning reading instruction or reading instruction in general. It's even held up in terms of like things that people that we'd like, that educators might almost want the finding to be a little bit different, like with class size. That it turns out that the teacher makes a bigger difference than the number of students in the room. And there are some reasons, you know, we can pick apart those studies and think about like why they might have turned out that way. But whenever we have large scale studies that look at like what variable is the one, the malleable variable, the one that we can do something about in the teaching learning interaction in school literacy development, it really is the teacher and not the stuff. It's not necessarily the number of kids in the room, although it makes a difference. It doesn't make the biggest difference. And there is an impact of leadership, but it isn't the biggest variable. So we really do keep coming back to like, if you want to make an investment in your school or in your community, the smartest investment to make is an investment in teachers, partly because they make the biggest difference, and also because they are there for they're there the longest. Like a human will outlast any material that you buy. And one of the things that Carol Connor's work does, if I'm thinking about the same thing that you're thinking about, one of the pieces that I love of hers that I think about often kind of takes the idea that like differentiating for everybody's individual needs is going to mean that you have to have as many lessons as children in your classrooms. And they basically found that there's sort of two groups that need different things in order to be equally successful. And that is students with less developed foundational skills need more teacher-directed support and more time with teachers in order to be as successful as their peers who have more developed foundational skills, who actually benefit from more student-directed practice and student discussion. And when those students that have more developed skills have more teacher-directed time, they actually don't do as well. And that actually sort of explains the main finding of the next generation of the Bond and Dykstra studies, which were the fourth grade studies and the first and fourth grade studies of the late 90s, which found something similar, although they weren't asking that question in particular. They found that the moment-by-moment teacher interactions, even in buildings where the same where teachers have the same resources and the same student population, when teachers make slightly different decisions about how they're using time and how they're introducing tasks and how they give feedback and how they give explanations, they have dramatically different results. So again, it's not the materials, it's how the materials are being framed and deployed.
Well, I think what's so important about, there's so much that's important about this, but spelling out the very many things that are within the teacher's control, what, no matter the materials you're getting, how are you organizing your day? How much time are you spending on things? Which children are getting which activities? Am I teaching the right thing to the right child at the right time?
Yeah.
Are they engaged in the kinds of lessons, whether student-driven or teacher-driven, that are going to help them learn the fastest? It's so much knowledge that teachers need to have, not just about the interactions of how to execute a good lesson, which if you're just following a script, you might be, oh, I just need to deliver this content. That is not what these studies show, is not what's going to help kids the most.
No, not at all. And I think we've got lots of evidence that teachers teaching in the same school, so arguably with the same set of materials and the same, at least the same recent professional development opportunities, that the differences between classrooms in the same school in terms of instructional quality and the nature of instruction are actually bigger than they are between schools that are like cities and states apart. And I've seen this firsthand. The first study I did when I moved to Connecticut was comparing discourse around reading comprehension instruction in two classrooms that were next door to each other, in one school that used a scripted curriculum and in a school that didn't. And the classrooms that were literally next door, same group, same everything, same script, same instructional coach, had drastic differences in student achievement that were easily traced to the differences in how teachers were using time, how they were responding to student questions, how they were eliciting student questions. It really has everything to do with the interactions that teachers are using materials and time and their knowledge to create. It's really not the materials. It doesn't mean materials are unimportant. It just means that the teacher's a whole lot more important.
Yeah. Yeah. And that even great materials in the hands of someone, one person versus another person, right, can be dramatically different outcomes. Yeah. And I'm thinking about this, just this book that you edited is just so timely, because we're thinking about, or I think a lot about, the unprecedented number of teacher vacancies, emergency certification, reduced requirements to get people into classrooms where they're still today. It's January and there are still hundreds of classrooms vacant in certain large school districts that I consult in. So that means there's people with less experience, less mentorship, less apprenticeship, less support potentially, who are working with students. And I think one intention from publishers sometimes is to try to teacher-proof. Like, okay, well, we'll just create this tech product, or we'll just create this program, so it doesn't matter who's delivering the instruction. Or or even further, we'll create this tech product where kids sit at a desk and just have the computer teach the child and eliminate the teacher variable. The teacher's sort of just like a manager instead. So I don't know. What are your thoughts about the relevance of this research in relation to what's happening today?
I think there's a way of reading the current policy story as ending with, let's just replace the teachers, it's too much of a mess. And you could think that a few different ways. There are more generous readings of the story, but this is there's reason to believe that policies are pointing in a direction that says, we want to remove the variation, because there is significant variation, as you were talking about, in teaching quality. We want to remove the human element of that because we can't really control it. And so we're just going to make it simpler. And we're going to, I hear the term level the playing field a lot, which is so funny, because I think where that term entered our lexicon as educators was somewhere around the first Elementary and Secondary Education Act in the 60s. And when people were talking about level the playing field at that moment in time, they were talking about putting more books in schools, hiring reading specialists for the first time, and changing funding formulas so that schools in districts with lower tax revenue had enough funding, not equal, but enough funding to provide a basic level of education. Speaking of leveling the playing field, this problem of not having educators or not having well-prepared or well-mentored or well-supported educators in every classroom is news to a lot of folks like me who have been working in schools where mostly there are teachers in every room. Like maybe we have this one hard to fill area. But that's not new in lots of communities. That's all been the case for a long time in lots of communities, that like there weren't any materials. There wasn't a teacher all year long. There weren't adequate supports or adequate training for many of the teachers in the building.
Right. And calling it high quality instructional materials. You're like, high quality? Yeah. Right. That sounds good. Who can argue
with that? Of course.
Right? Right?
Yeah. Sounds beautiful. Right.
So you're saying the trap is it's really just about standards alignment is what makes it high quality?
In our current conversation about in the U.S. current conversation about it, circa like the last 3 years. And part of the reason for that is like the rise of Ed reports is like really the only place that you can go to look for ratings of curriculum, like comparative ratings of curriculum. They like provided something in the marketplace that wasn't there that is really handy. But you have to pass through like gateway number one for Ed reports is it standards aligned? And if they can't see all of it, or if it's like, it's up to the teacher what text you use, or it's up to the teacher which activity, then we can't guarantee that it's standards aligned because we don't know what they chose. So there are a lot of things that get kind of like knocked out before they get analyzed for anything else. So Ed Reports does analyze for other things, but the first thing they look for is standards alignment. And there's logic behind that. That's not like a horrible idea, but it's one way to cut it. And so we're not really looking at curriculum quality at the moment, or like instructional material quality at the moment, because we're looking at standards alignment and a couple other things. We could say like quality is how well does it work, but we don't have that information. Or quality is how much do teachers appreciate it? We really don't have that information because nobody's been asking that question.
Yeah. And if you go back to the teacher quality studies that we were talking about before, right, thinking about what are the things that they're measuring when it comes to teacher quality? They're measuring how much time they spend on things, micro interactions, adjusting for different students. Are they saying, oh, teacher has the leeway to make modifications according to what students need? Or there's a assessment and instruction cycle built in so that teachers can make decisions. Is that part of what makes a material high quality, given what we know from the teacher quality? No.
No. And there's a piece of that. Like, I think there's an attempt toward it. So it's not like completely missing and ignored. There's an attempt. It's an incomplete attempt. And then there's also, you know, if this is the story of sort of education measurement period, like the tools for teacher evaluation are asking for a version of teaching that assumes a bunch of things about what good teaching is. And they don't always line up with like research on good literacy teaching in particular, or good foreign language teaching in particular, or good music teaching in particular. There's actually some contrast and contradictions in there. And then people need to make judgments about what do we want: good generic teaching, whatever that is, or do we want good literacy teaching, which is a little bit different than what many teacher evaluation rubrics are looking for, in part because it's really important that students have a lot of practice reading and writing and talking about text. And that doesn't look like anything. Like, to be honest, if you walk into a room and kids are all reading, there's not a lot to take notes on. I mean, I guess you and I probably could find lots of things that
would
be interesting.
Well, I was like, I could say, like, are kids engaged?
But on the rubric, it's like, I'm not counting participation, like the equitable participation. I'm not counting, I can't look at question types. I can't look at most of the things that show up on teacher evaluation rubrics if the kids are just writing. That's all they're doing? Are you kidding? And that is like one of the marks of some good literacy instruction. But it doesn't show up as the teacher doing anything, which actually I think is great. If they've created conditions for learning that they don't have to sort of manage at all moments. But it doesn't show up the same way. And similarly, things we know about really great instruction and the role of instructional materials and teachers using them flexibly and going between them and matching them to readers, to students, and making adjustments based on assessments really kind of contradicts the idea that we need to see curriculum that is where the scope and sequence is the same for everybody. mm-hmm. where it's pre-sequenced and it's pre-paced. And we know exactly what you're going to do in what order, no matter who you're teaching or when. Mm-hmm. There's a contradiction there. There's like, mm-hmm. why would we teach something that some kids already know? Wouldn't that waste their time and disengage them? Yes, yes, it would. But mm-hmm. it's difficult to measure it without saying like, we want it to be a model. We want folks to have on paper this sort of idealized version, which actually I don't think we would want the ideal. It really reminds me of sort of like the images for advertisements for like the diet, wellness, fitness industries of like, this is the idealized human form. But you actually don't want that. And so we might say like, wow, this is a beautifully written unit plan or curriculum map. Everything fits perfectly and everything is sequenced beautifully and it's super logical and it's vertically aligned and horizontally and isn't it gorgeous on paper? But you don't actually want to live that because kids don't come in needing exactly the same thing, knowing exactly the same thing and moving at the same pace. Like as soon as you start teaching from instructional materials, they are the least important thing and the students are the most important thing. And like, it's only as good as it is flexible. So we can't rate that unless we're rating it in use.
Yeah. Yeah. Only as good as it is flexible. I think it's really, really important. And I think not exactly what a lot of the state approved lists, if you looked closely at the materials that are considered to be high quality, I would not say that, I mean, you've done more of this looking than I have, say that they're super flexible.
No.
And if you think about like, you know, you talked a little bit about skills and the kinds of skills kids need and tracking those skills. And there's also, you talk in a second article, or sorry, a second chapter in this book about knowledge building curriculums and mm-hmm. how those are very common on state approved lists, along with a phonics program to build phonics skills. Yeah. And you raise important questions around whose knowledge is in this knowledge building curriculum. Yeah. Where does culturally and linguistically relevant instruction fit in? And you talk about both in this chapter and in the previous one, how critical culturally and linguistically relevant practices are mm-hmm. to be considered high quality teaching, right. high quality materials. What are you seeing in relation to that?
What we're seeing is not very progressive at all. None of it's new. Most of it is pretty sort of like, it's in this spirit of teacher proofing. It's in the spirit of like, let's make sure that there is sort of a lowest common denominator that everybody's got. At the very least, we can say that we covered everything in order for a reasonable amount of time. And then we can say that we covered that it wasn't the curriculum, it wasn't the material's fault, it was something else. No one would say, I'm fine with having low quality curriculum. Nobody's fine with that. But that also is a distraction, largely, because we have pretty good evidence that materials are a variable. Yes, they cause some variation, but they don't cause significant variation. And one of the main moderators of that is like, is how well the teacher uses them. So it may actually be that like, there is a good curricular program for you and a good one for me, and they're different. Like, I'm a better user of this kind of program than you are. And that's only because of my preparation and training and my disposition and what I'm allowed to try and not allowed to try. I think the challenge at the moment with these tools is not that they are good or bad. It's that the conversation around them suggests that they are going to solve the problem and that teachers are going to are being asked to get out of the way and follow the program, like to get in line and do the thing. And what we really need to be asking teachers to do is learn their students well and respond effectively. That was always the name of the game. That is always going to be the name of the game. And we can get in teachers' ways by requiring that they do certain actions, requiring that they do certain assessments, requiring that they spend a certain amount of time on X, Y, and Z. And that will get in the way of them being responsive, which was always what we should have been going for. And it'll look like high achievement or low achievement. It'll look like, oh, this program's great or that program's great. But a lot of that is just what it looks like. What's happening underneath is a teacher's making decisions. And their decisions are limited in part by what they're allowed to try and what they know about.
Just a final synthesizing question. If you were to design a classroom for early literacy, what would it look like?
Yeah, excited about this question, partly because I don't have an easy or a ready answer for it. And partly because I have a kindergartner right now. And so I'm thinking about this all the time. Like, so the easiest place for me to start is like non-negotiables. They've got to read, write, and talk about reading and writing every day. And I don't want to hear the whole, but they don't know how to read or write yet because everybody is literate one way or another. We need to like see the ways that they're using literacy in their everyday lives or even in their school lives. Notice it, like name it as what it is and build on exactly what they've got going on. Like if I had to pick my favorite part of all lessons, I really love interactive writing in a writing lesson. I think it's super cool. I really love interactive read alouds in a lesson. I think they are super cool. Like it's like, and partly because they're like the mix up part of like,
right.
Not necessarily expert novice, but there's like someone who already has, someone who can demonstrate and like manipulate a reading writing process and someone who's like exploring it like with support. So they can't actually fall down. They like somebody's kind of holding the back of the bicycle. I remember, this might sound real silly, but I remember like guitars and pianos in kindergarten classrooms and that like somehow magically all kindergarten teachers would play them. I don't know if that was real, but that's part of my like way back hazy memory of things. Maybe because my mom was one of those guitar wielding kindergarten types. But I think about sort of the protective factors of the arts and the enjoyment engagement factors of the arts. And the neurological supports for literacy that are engaged there. And I think about like, we don't have to be sitting at our desk holding books to be developing literacy. And so much of what we're doing right now with this like explicit phonemic awareness instruction happened as song and chants and poetry and other sorts of like social and culturally engaged, if not relevant, at least engaged activities. And I wonder what it would look like if they were more relevant. Back, but relevant. So I don't know, like kindergarten would be like, there'd be a garden, there'd be singing, there'd be dancing, there'd be like instruments for kids to like make rhythms with, because we know that like rhythm is a good predictor of literacy. And also like developing rhythm is like a much more engaging way to develop some of the underlying skills for early literacy than some of our other options. And there'd be audiences to write to and messages that are sent to the kids that they have to understand. So they really are like decoding because they want to know, not decoding to demonstrate their decoding prowess.
So integrated, highly engaged, relevant, playful.
Yeah. Because it should be.
It should be.
Yeah.
Because
play
so
teaches
fun.
Better. Like even if it's just for the instrumental reason, mm-hmm. play teaches better. I appreciate that you used the word integration there because I didn't stumble my way into it. But I feel like that's when I work with third and fourth graders who are struggling in school, they have the skills in isolation. They just haven't had the integration practice. Integration is like the name of the game.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much.
And I always learn from talking to you. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you, Jen.
And now I'll welcome my colleagues, Molly Wood, Macy Kerbs, for a discussion about that interview with Dr. Rachel Gabriel. Molly, Macy, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about?
Oh my goodness. She painted a picture with, as a parent and a teacher, I would want my kid to be in that school, and I would want to teach in that school.
It's a good test, right? Do I want to teach in that school? Do I want my own children to be in that school?
And I think it might prevent some of the compliance we see, because as kids progress through these really scripted or schools that have them go through the motions of doing school without the play and opportunities to just be okay making mistakes, they become a little bit more quiet. They become compliant. We see a rise in behavior issues.
The first thing that came to mind was actually this conversation I had recently with this phenomenal kindergarten teacher that I work with. And we were thinking about a specific child. And he's very quiet. He's developing his proficiency, you know, the use and acquisition of the English language. And he's not showing his best self at times in the day where we would typically think of assessing him, right? And so I had asked her, I said, okay, so like, where does he come alive? Where is he, what part of the day is he most engaged? And she said, well, when we're playing, when he's in the kitchen, actually, specifically. So I said, so what kind of work could you do with him in the kitchen? And this is just coming back to, like, you know, play, choice time, all the work around that that I take no credit for, right? I mean, that's just like when kids are playing, that's the big work. And can he label parts of the kitchen? Can he make functional writing in the kitchen? Can he make menus or label, you know, make to-do lists or how-tos for washing his hands or, you know, recipes in his own emergent writing with those skills?
Well, I think that question you ask, when does he come most alive? When is he most himself? Those questions, you know, if we can ask that to understand any child and then consider, thinking back to Rachel's findings from teacher quality and from material quality, it's about giving teachers the flexibility to say, okay, well, given what I know about the student, I'm not going to proceed with this lesson as scripted because that's not going to support this particular student. There has to be flexibility and there has to be room for responsiveness, just like you said, Molly, and creativity, honestly, in the same way that we're envisioning these classroom spaces that are filled with creativity and joy. There's so much creativity and joy in teaching when teachers are given the flexibility to do that, to study children, to appreciate what they do, to honor their current strengths, and to follow up from that to wherever you're trying to go. Of course, you have end of year objectives and standards in mind, but how you get there, the extent to which you can make that unique for each learner, I think it's just really powerful and it makes the classroom an even more joyful space.
Kind of makes me wonder if maybe we've been putting too much weight on materials. As a teacher, I've seen what she was talking about, like these recycled programs coming back that I used my first year of teaching that are now being, you know, they look very similar, but they've been revised. So I wonder if that weight would disappear if we just valued teachers' decisions and invested, like she said, in our teachers by providing good quality PD that's not focused on a curriculum, but focused on knowledge building of teachers and being responsive to kids.
You know what I'm reminded of too, Macy, is I'm thinking back to that study. I can't remember the authors offhand, but I can link to it in the show notes. That study we read as a consulting team about what's the PD that has the best mm-hmm. impact on teachers and also on students. And it wasn't PD on materials. It wasn't even like going too deep into content, it was more about teacher practices. And the more the PD could center on teacher practices, the more impactful it is. So I know we talked a little bit as a team about just how, of course, you're building knowledge of children, of reading process, of writing process, as you practice conferences and small group instruction. But yeah, it's not programs. It's not PD around programs, definitely.
I appreciated that she brought up the fact that it's not going to look the same in every single place. And these materials should be just that, a guide and lesson planning. And so how she was talking about coherence is like we have to find that middle ground where we're not requiring this scope and sequence to be delivered, you know, in a systematic, robotic way, but a way where we can still honor teacher decision making without it feeling compliant or a free for all. And so I don't know what that happy medium is, but I know a lot of schools have achieved that coherence. And I think that's, to me, when you ask, like, what should a classroom look like or what should a school feel like, that to me was what she described, was that middle ground between not too loose, but not too tight.
And I think it's also a really hard thing to define or to spell out precisely if you're honoring that a good classroom is responsive to the students in the room. And a good teacher is a teacher who's teaching to the kids in front of them. So it's hard to say 30 minutes a day for independent reading. That's the magic number. And you should allot, you know, X number of minutes for do X number of small groups a day. It depends. It depends on so many things. But I think keeping the principles that she talked about in mind are helpful when we think about designing the classroom and the literacy block.
You know, you said something interesting. You said, you know, a good teacher. And I think we all go into classrooms assuming they're good teachers, right? Like when I meet a teacher, like that's my first assumption. I just assume you are a great teacher. You can feel their passion. You can feel their desire to learn. That's just what I assume. I think some of these alternatives of the curriculum she was describing that are considered high quality, but they are saying that teachers don't have this knowledge or they might need more scaffolds. I kind of wonder if maybe they're assuming teachers in that deficit view instead of the asset-based way of approaching a teacher with professional respect and knowing that they've worked really hard to get into this profession. They've not only passed all of these certification tests, but taken really rigorous courses. They've done really rigorous field work.
Very well said. Totally agree with you. Let's end there with our last, as a last thought. Thank you both so much for joining me today. I really appreciated the conversation.
Me too. Thank you, Jen.
And thank you for listening. Please support the To the Classroom podcast by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on whatever platform you use to get your podcasts. Learn more about me and my work at my website, www.jennifersaravallo.com.